Welcome to Mustard A&M's. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
And we discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest, such as movies, TV, DVD, what have you. missed a week because I had family in town, and we're recording late on Sunday because I had people in my house making noise all day. Very, very disconcerting when you like a quiet house.
I can imagine.
I don't have a whole, well, like the last time, I say we don't have a whole lot to talk about, and then we went an hour anyway. we'll see what happens. I have not seen anything new. I haven't seen The Hulk. I haven't seen, I know. I'm surprised too, because that's like, you would think that that would be one of something that I would see. Just definitely, you know, sort of without question, you're going to see it. And yet, I haven't seen it. I don't really even have I haven't had time on Friday, but I mowed the lawn instead. It's just, I don't know. I want to see it. I just don't need to see it immediately or need to see it in the theater.
Well, I saw it. I saw Hulk. And I saw Get Smart this week, too.
Well, you are appropriately seeing movies for two guys who talk about movies.
That's true. Well, I didn't. I went with my dad again, as usual. So, but I saw Hulk and I saw Get Smart. And then I watched some DVDs.
So I watched I watched Death Proof, which was your copy.
Yep.
And did I see some other things last weekend? I think we ended up watching a bunch of stuff. I also saw the Sting.
Oh yeah.
Which was on one of the
25 years.
It was on one of the random HD channels, and I was like, I haven't seen this in probably 10 years. Pop that in, or hit record.
Tell you the truth, I don't think I've ever actually seen it all the way through.
Oh. And I think I saw some other, like I saw Miami Vice again, the Ridley, is that Ridley, Michael Mann?
Yep.
Yeah, I saw the Michael Mann Miami Vice again last weekend or the week before, and I'm looking at my DVD rack, looking to see what else, because I think I saw another one or two films that weekend. But anyway, so let's talk about Incredible Hulk. What did you think?
What was one of the reviews they called? The headline was "The Adequate Hulk," and that's about right. I mean, it wasn't. It's hard to describe, but it definitely was. Given the tenor that Marvel has set with Iron Man and other stuff, it definitely was in keeping with that, but it wasn't particularly great. It was much better than I would have expected it, and way better than that first trailer led me to believe. That first trailer was so bad, and things that looked so dumb in that trailer, in the context of the movie, seemed way, way better. But it was, it was okay. It wasn't totally great, and it didn't totally blow, you know. And what's funny is looking at the reviews and stuff. A lot of reviews they would talk about in context of how the first one was just hated and everything. And I was looking at the Rotten Tomatoes listing, and they got basically exactly the same rating. Yet somehow it's been built up in people's minds that the first one was loathed. And it wasn't. It got like a 62 on the tomato reading, and this one got like a 65, which is identical.
Well,
you know?
Did I see a thing on Wells that they were actually on track to make the same amount of money, or am
yeah.
I just
well, there,
am
it's
I confusing myself with your email?
Ironically, it was making, you know, it was matching the first one almost exactly, although the first one had a bigger opening weekend. And it dropped off titanically. This one had a slightly smaller opening weekend, but it didn't drop off quite as much. You know, the stink wasn't quite there. And I think, and like everything, it's hard to know how this will play internationally, but just in the last 3 years, because the dollar's so weak, we tend to forget how big of a deal international is, so it'll probably do better internationally. But anyway, it wasn't bad. I mean, it was... it was great in a lot of areas, and it had all the requisite stuff you'd expect, and it wasn't Iron Man. Let's put it that way.
Well, and like I said, I'm a comic book guy. I'm a huge fan of Peter David, who wrote like a 12-year run of the Hulk comic book.
Yep.
I don't read it now, but you know, I like the first film, and I want to see it. I just don't feel compelled to run out right now, you know, drop $9 and see it in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in the scope of the summer movies that are comic book, in order, it would have probably been of my interest: Iron Man, then probably Hellboy, then probably Dark Knight, and Hulk fourth. And I want to see all of them, or I wanted to see all of them. So, and they're, at least so far, playing out to meet expectations. We'll see how Hellboy is. But I definitely am looking forward to that.
Yeah. Talk about Get Smart, which just got... the reviews I'm seeing, with one exception, which was just one of my... In fact, Peter David's blog, talking about him, his little mini review was that he liked it. And everyone else seems to just be...
Well, Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars. You know, the thing about Get Smart is it had the tremendously great fortune to come out on the same weekend as The Love Guru, which got I've never actually seen a movie get, you know, when you go to the top critics in Rotten Tomatoes, get zero for top critics. Zero. It didn't get a single tomato. It was beyond bad. So because of that, Get Smart, which didn't get great reviews, seemed okay in comparison. And anyway, it wasn't a bad movie. It wasn't particularly great, and it should have been funnier, but there was a lot of parts that were good, and Steve Carell was inspired, and it wasn't bad. It's just nothing great, but I guess compared to The Love Guru, it probably seemed like Orson Welles in comparison. So, I mean, I would say that I'm glad I didn't pay for it, and it was a nice way to kill 2 hours. It wasn't bad. Definitely a movie, if it comes up on cable, that you should set your TiVo for. But other than that, nothing particularly great about it. Plus, I find her odd-looking. Pardon?
You find her what-looking?
Anne Hathaway odd-looking. Her, head is too small, and her mouth is too big, and her nose is too odd. I just find her weird looking. But she was okay in the movie.
When you reject her, you can send her on down to my house, and I will attend to her needs.
Well, they're having this comparison in the Los Angeles Times between Jessica Alba and Anne Hathaway and comparing their careers, and I couldn't help but thinking, well, I'll take Jessica Alba any day. But anyway, so it was okay. It wasn't great. Nothing. No great shakes.
Just FYI, I'm getting some weird Skype behaviors, dropping you out every so often, but then you come back 2 words later.
Well, I can hear you, so as long as you can totally figure me out, we'll probably stick with it. So the thing is, there's like a lot of indie movies that are out, but none of them are playing close. Like that Mongol is out, and the Bigger, Stronger, Faster is out, but they're all like in downtown Seattle. And for whatever reason, driving down to the U District or downtown Seattle doesn't excite me much anymore.
Yeah, no kidding. And The Love Guru is just getting trashed. I think the only review I've actually read was a couple of paragraphs on Ain't It Cool News. And the Ain't It Cool guy was just taking it to town and saying, this is about the level of comedy you would get from superhero movie or epic movie or the Spartan movie.
Yeah.
Those kinds of
There's some reviews out there. Films. They have really gone to town. I can't remember the one, but one of them says, boy, this movie is so bad that it makes you question whether you will ever laugh again. I mean, it was like,
wow.
it was bad. Let me just see if I can find, a couple of them. Cause the way people are going at it, they hate it with such a passion. It's beyond bad. The only movie I've ever seen that got worse reviews than this one was, Dana Carvey movie, Master of Disguise. Remember that one?
Oh, yes.
That one, if I remember right, that one got like a 1% on the tomato meter, And I think this one got like a 5% or something. So, but it, the reviews were so bad that I almost, you know, actually the reason why I went to Get Smart is I was running over to my dad and uncle's house on Friday, and I was just stopping by to say hi, and they were coming the other direction. I go, where are you going? Oh, we're going to go see that Love Guru. You want to see it? And I go, no. Well, we can see Get Smart instead. And I go, okay. So we went and saw that. But, okay, the Love Guru got 16% on the tomato meter. Get Smart got 51%, and which, all things here isn't bad considering how many are bad, but let me just see. Okay, so the Love Guru, 16%. Oh, now it's made it up to 7% for the top critics. And by way of comparison, I'm going to try Master of Disguise and just see how that little monstrosity did. D-I-S-G-I-S. And Master of Disguise got, looks like, 2%. That has got to be the worst reviewed movie of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. So, anyway.
Wow.
Odd time for movies, but so you know what I also did though this week is I pulled out Toy Story to watch again. For whatever reason, mm-hmm. I don't know what, something prompted me to pull out my DVD of Toy Story. And there's some things that struck me. The first one was, how did I forget that Joss Whedon wrote Toy Story? Did you remember that? Did you know that?
Only because I heard that mentioned somewhat recently, probably in one of the Dollhouse interviews.
Oh yeah, it threw me.
But
I forgot.
Prior to that, no.
I think I remembered he had written. I mean, of course, we knew he wrote the original movie Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I think I had remembered him writing Alien Resurrection. I had no idea. So anyway, that was weird. The other weird thing was there's no Pixar logo at the front of this movie. You just sort of assume it's Pixar branded, but at the time they just sort of did this independently and found a distributor. So it was really.
Yep, sorry. Lost after the distributor.
So anyway, it was interesting that they ended up that it was like really branded totally as Disney. The other thing that was weird is I was looking in the credits. At the very end of the credits, it said something effective, see more Toy Story online at www.toystory.com. And it's important to remember, this thing came out in 1995. And, you know, most people were not on the internet back then. That was a long time ago. So I was kind of struck to see what had to be one of the very first URLs listed in credits ever. I just thought that was interesting. And then the other thing about it, which I thought was interesting, was that the it looked great, but it's starting to show its age in a way that I never thought it would, because it always looked so great, and now it just looks really kind of simple, and the story was exceedingly simple in a beautiful way, but when you contrast it to like Ratatouille, which is simple but relatively complex in a more of a subtle way, it's a totally different experience. I started to think of it like how you look at old-fashioned movies and you start to appreciate them, but they're not really comparable to a modern movie, and that's sort of what Toy Story was looking like to me.
Yeah. Well, just to kind of digress on that for a minute, WALL-E comes out on Friday.
Oh my God, is that already this Friday?
27th, and I'm getting more and more excited about it.
Yeah.
Partly because a couple of different factors. I'd heard for a while that this particular movie was going to be really hard for them to market.
Because there's no talking.
Because it's not.
At least early on.
Well, the main character doesn't talk. They've shown some human characters doing some talking, but it seems like the majority of the film isn't dialogue driven.
Yeah.
So that's a hard sell. It's space, which I guess is a hard sell. And then I ran across a blurb on Ain't It Cool saying that at least a portion of it, I don't know how much, is fairly bleak.
Yeah, the beginnings. Like, he's like the only robot for like the first like half hour of this movie that after like everybody's left Earth, and he just there to clean up and do his job.
No, they weren't talking about that section. They were talking about something else. Okay. But yeah, take it within the context of it's ain't it cool.
Yeah.
Either way, it sounds more and more interesting and more like, well, it's a science fiction film, and I'm totally – that's me. You're just – that's – I'm your target audience.
Yeah.
So I'm just really looking forward to that. And especially like, you know, the no talking. You know, usually when someone says a film is really hard to market, that's something you should see.
Yeah.
That's usually a quality
effort. Well, let's put it this way. I've always been mezzo on leading up to every Pixar movie. For whatever reason, when they're coming in, I'm going, okay, I know I'm probably going to like this, but what the hell is this about? And with the exception of Cars, which I liked but didn't love, every single one has blown me away in one shape or another. So from that alone, I'm assuming it's going to be fantastic. But it was interesting to hear Andrew Stanton on the commentary 12 years ago talking about Toy Story and to talk about all this new stuff they were trying that now they're like the masters of. But you can just hear them inventing that stuff. And, of course, Wall-E is, you know, they had that great teaser trailer last year where it was Andrew Stanton talking about, so after Toy Story came out, they sat down and they mapped out where we were going to go, and then they mapped out Monsters, Inc. and A Bug's Life and I think Finding Nemo and maybe Ratatouille, and then this one, Wall-E, is, you know, it's kind of I'm definitely looking forward to, even though I have no clue what it's going to be about. I just know whatever it is, they're always great, except for Cars, which was just good.
Well, I quite enjoyed it.
I did too. It just didn't stick with me like the other ones. It just seemed a little contrived, but yeah.
So I popped in your copy of Death Proof.
Yeah.
And I should say, I didn't see this in the theater. I just didn't get that. Was a big chunk of time. I loved the idea of Richard Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino doing this double feature and hamming
Robert
it up.
Rodriguez.
And sorry, you're right. I loved that idea. I thought it was pretty ballsy. And I kept hoping, and I assumed they'd put out a DVD, a Grindhouse DVD of both features and all the stuff. And they haven't done it.
Yeah,
and I find that completely stunning.
And apparently all those features were, why aren't they putting out a big blowout with the extended versions of each movie? And because apparently these ads that they showed in between them are really clever and some of the funniest things with them. It's just bizarre.
Right.
Like every other Tarantino thing that he's involved with, he's so involved with doing the perfect thing that they just never come out in video. Where is the, where'd the Kill Bill special edition go?
I know. It was marketed.
I know.
All right. Amazon for a bit had it for last Christmas.
Yep.
And then I heard a bit where he was, he was arranging to have an additional anime sequence built.
Yeah.
To insert into it. And you're like, dude, just
put the thing
put
out.
Put them together and put it out. Let's go. Yeah. Here's my money. Take my money. anyway, so that's, I would, if they put out a Grindhouse combo, I would buy it, but they haven't. So I borrowed your Death Proof.
Yep.
And it was really interesting. Cause they filmed it in this very retro style with, they put scratches in the film. They had errors in the, you know, as if the film had been, you know, run through the sprockets a gazillion times and had been spliced bad in a few spots. And then I was kind of like, oh, okay, cool. I get what they're doing here. And then they set it in modern day.
I know.
So
they did that real purposely. It throws you.
Because
early on, you're assuming it's 1970s, and all of a sudden, boom. I love that, honestly. I thought that was cool.
I thought it was, too. I wasn't really sure what to expect. I thought that Kurt Russell's car was mystical, as opposed to it just being reinforced.
Yeah.
So I kind of, you know, the first half went about how I expected it to, and then it did this whole second half, and I really didn't know what to expect, and I certainly didn't expect the ending.
Yeah.
But it's cool in that I had no idea where it was going or how it was going to end, so however it ended would have been fine with me. I would have been quite pleasantly surprised. And there was this one scene, I don't want to spoil it too much, but this New Zealand character pops up out of a string of bushes and says, "I'm fine," which I thought was hysterical.
It was.
Just the way she did that, the way Tarantino had that done, it was not at all what I was expecting.
Well, a lot of that stuff, I mean, it was a lot of it was direct references from these movies that would do stuff like that, including the final high five at the end kind of thing, where it just sort of ended on this oddly chipper note after something so horrible. But it was, but yeah, and that chick there, I looked online to see, who is this person? I never heard her before, and it turns out she's a stunt woman that they hired to be in the movie.
Well,
I guess to hire her because
she was
hot, I guess.
Well, the other thing I was going to say was the stunt work that she did at the end was incredible. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, were there safety lines that they digitally erased? I'm trying to figure out how they did it, because it was really impressive.
Well, they made a big point by talking about how everything was practical. But I can only assume, I mean, it's one thing to make it practical and not do digital, but it's another thing to not have safety and just erase safety harnesses, because some of that would be insane to put somebody in that kind of risk.
Oh, exactly. I was also really impressed with how it was shot, which, you know, Quentin Tarantino was his own DP.
Yep.
And I was like, wow, you know, visually, this is really, I like what he's doing here. So I was, you know, it's just like, dude, you need to make some more movies.
Yeah. I know. It's just weird. The whole thing, I loved the whole thing. Cohesively, it didn't gel together for me, but that wasn't a bad thing. It just sort of seemed like a typical Tarantino thing. He always talks about him writing 20-minute mini-movies, and then he puts them together. He says, that's kind of how I do it. And if you look at his movies, that's exactly how they're all put together. And this one here, it's the same way. So I'm thinking specifically of the... in the Roadhouse when him and Vanessa Ferlito are coming on, thinking, oh my God, she is so freaking hot. And then all of a sudden, there's some other totally thing that almost, they may have the same characters, but it doesn't even relate to each other. And it didn't really matter to me because I loved everything, but it wasn't cohesive in any way, like Kill Bill kind of all added up and Pulp Fiction beautifully added up. But again, I didn't mind it. I just watching that, I end up realizing how much I love just Tarantino, whatever he's doing, because he just seems to have it all together to such a degree, even if it's not like a grand Tarantino opus movie, you know. And I wonder, you know, he's supposedly doing this Inglourious Bastards movie, and now he's saying, well, it's going to be a two-part movie, too. And I'm thinking, oh, dude, just stop doing that stuff. Just put a movie out, get it out. But whatever he does, I'm looking forward to it, because apparently he's actually working and he's, like, got his mojo back.
So, and then I watched The Sting.
Yeah,
what
do you think of that?
Like I said, I haven't seen it in a long time. I think it holds up really well. There were aspects of it that don't weather quite as well, but on the whole did weather really well.
Yeah.
I had forgotten that it was George Roy Hill.
Yep.
So it's pretty much almost the same team that did, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yep.
I can't remember if it's the same writer. I probably should.
I can't remember. No, one of them was the famous William Goldman. I don't know if he wrote The Sting, but he wrote Butch Cassidy. He was the big writer of the 70s. And he also wrote The Princess Bride.
But he, I had forgotten that there were title cards, sort of like chapter cards.
Yep.
You know, and there's this, it's kind of this very up movie, and it just kind of goes along, and it's like you're almost never in doubt that the good guys are going to win. And you don't care. It's just, how is it going to happen?
Yeah.
But I found it really held up. I thought the acting was funny and crisp. And the, you know, it holds up really well. And Robert Redford and Paul Newman are both great. And it includes one of my favorite lines I had totally forgotten. So I guess it couldn't have been that much of a favorite line. But this great intro line where Paul Newman, when he sees Robert Redford, kind of says, "Good to meet you, kid. You're a real horse's ass." It's like, I love that. You know, and it's a fun movie, and it's you know, if it pops up, if you see it, it's definitely worth recording. I don't know that I need to go out and buy the DVD. It doesn't have quite the same replay value as Butch Cassidy does, but because the dialogue on that one's just so sharp. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. I thought it held up
David
really well.
David S. Ward. And he wrote Major League, Major League 2, Sleepless in Seattle, King Ralph, Major League Back to the Minors. And, oh, boy, he wrote that Flyboys. Remember when that thing came out last year about, I think, World War One flying aces, and it just apparently was so jingoistic and ridiculous. And he's got some movie in production right now called Buddha. So, but The Sting was his second movie, and he won the Oscar for it.
All right, well, well-deserved.
And he's directed Major League, Major League 2, The Program, Down Periscope with the... with our friend Kelsey Grammer, and so he's been bouncing around.
Why is he our friend?
I don't know. I just throw that out there. But he clearly started out strong and then settled into a nice, comfortable Hollywood career.
Whatever buys you that new kitchen. let's see. So TV-wise. Have you been watching the NASA missions on Discovery?
Yep. In fact, I was watching that just as you called, the final one. The one right now is all about the space shuttle.
You know, I hadn't planned on doing it, and then I kind of stumbled across one, and I was like, all right, I guess I should watch it. And, of course, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, they've got these interviews, and it's interesting because, you know, I felt like I knew a fair amount about the early space program.
Yeah.
You know, from a combination of different sources, like, you know, watching Apollo 13 a lot, but also, I didn't watch the Tom Hanks From the Earth to the Moon series, which Jesus. I heard was really good.
Those are incredible.
But there was, I think there were a few other Nova or Frontline-esque, not really Frontline, but those sorts of documentary programs about that, which I'd watched a fair bit. So I felt pretty well informed about it. And yet there were things that I was still learning, or, you know, it's kind of like you'd recognize the names, but you couldn't put them in context, or you didn't, you know, you couldn't say, you know, Alan Shepard. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that he was the first American in space. But and
damn,
then I'd completely
dude.
Forgotten.
I would have been able to tell you.
No.
Because I'm a Jeopardy nerd.
I know, because I would have recognized the name as an astronaut.
Well, partially
and even then, I...
The Right Stuff for the longest time was my totally favorite movie, so I had that committed to heart.
Okay. You know, I could have told you Neil Armstrong on the moon and Buzz Aldrin was the second guy. I didn't even realize that the first flights into space weren't orbits. They were just kind of
first two
parabolas, I guess.
Which killed them because
so anyway.
Yuri Gagarin was in orbit. His was in orbit, and then we did two suborbital flights, which was really the right thing to do, but distressing to the American pilots.
Well, anyway, it's pretty well done, and I'm pleased that it's not a 20-part series. You know, it seems like there's like, I don't know how many of these, four,
three.
Five, six, something like that.
Three.
And three?
Yep, three two-hour shows. There was
Excuse
one
me,
two
then,
weeks ago, and it was two, and it had it was Apollo. I mean, it was a Mercury, Gemini.
Well,
then Apollo,
then,
and then the third one is this week, which is
then somebody is screwing up in terms of putting them into the guide system for Dish Network. Either they're chunking them out because it's recorded a couple of 2-hour episodes, but it's also recorded some 1-hour episodes.
Oh, I may be mistaken.
So no, well. They've screwed things up like that before, so they might be chunking them out differently. Who knows?
Yeah, I might be wrong.
Anyway, it's really impressive, and you know they're using all this NASA footage that's never been released, and some of it really is impressive in HD. You know, some stuff if you take footage and put it in HD, all you can see is, you know, that's a high definition, you know, crack on the film.
More green.
But some of this stuff is really impressive. Anyway, I was just, that's a sort of TV that, you know, I can totally fall for. You know, it's Discovery, science-y, spacey, high definition. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I liked it. And you can always tell, it's going to be a good documentary when they manage to convince Neil Armstrong to be interviewed, because he never does any interviews, ever. He hates it, unlike Buzz Aldrin. But there's been a couple he's been part of, this being one of them. And so when he's being interviewed, you go, okay, well, they know, they really got the right people involved. And they were able to talk to him into it, so, which is, you know, great.
You know, there's some other larger things going on that we haven't talked about, the whole SAG-AFTRA thing.
Yeah.
Which I don't really want to get into other than to say, I was a member of AFTRA for a while.
Yeah. And was that you were required to be that?
Yes.
How much did they charge you a year for that?
God, I don't remember. I don't remember what the month – I can't remember if it was a monthly or an annual and how they pulled it out. But because one of the radio stations I worked at, not the one I'm technically still employed with, but another one that was in the same family, was covered under AFTRA, so I had to join. And my reaction based on that was that it was pretty much useless for the part-time employees.
Yeah.
It didn't do them any good whatsoever. And I'm pretty biased about that because I've worked at UPS before, which is the Teamsters union, and they, at least when I was working there, part-timers had, you know, full medical benefits.
Yeah.
And all sorts of great benefits as a result of being unionized. And, you know, you can go union, anti-union, that's a whole different discussion. But if you were to compare the two, it's like AFTRA was a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand if they're serving their membership in different ways. You know, I never really got into the details of that. But I think I was a member while they were going through some contract renegotiations. I don't think we had to strike over it. But my recollection from talking with others who were more involved in it was that AFTRA just rolled over and said yes to everything that the company wanted.
Nice.
Which really struck me as, well, you know, well, then what's the point? Anyway, so when I hear that there's drama between SAG and AFTRA, I kind of like root for SAG, although I haven't really investigated that situation. But it really seems unhealthy because they're sort of sniping at each other instead of presenting a united front against the producers.
Of course, and the producers are just jumping for joy.
God, no kidding. And as this comes up, the actors who are members of both unions are really going to have a choice to make. I don't know. I find the whole thing repulsive and amateurish.
Yeah.
You know, why can't we all just deal with this as adults? But
the only way they're going to be successful is if they stand together. It's unbelievable that they would purposely, you know, decide we're not going to negotiate together. We're going to do this separately. I mean, it's just insanity. But
it really is.
Yeah.
God, what else? There was one or two other larger scope things that I wanted to talk about. Now I can't remember them. Oh, well. They did, since we've last spoken, they've announced the new iPhone.
Yep.
God, and I'm a huge Apple dork, wanted the first one, couldn't quite justify spending the money, for that memory size. And, you know, everyone knew that it wasn't as fast as it could be.
Yep.
So I went into work that day and I'm IMing my buddy Preston, you know, as we're both refreshing Engadget through the keynote, you know, and I can't remember what work I was doing. I was actually doing work and managing to hit Engadget and Gizmodo at the same time. And meanwhile, we're IMing each other back and forth about, oh, this is cool, this is cool, did you hear this yet? And at the end of it, when he says it's not going to be released till July 11th, I was heartbroken. I was so ready. You know, I went into work that day thinking, I'm going to stop by the Apple Store on my way home and get me one of these. And when he said I had to wait another month, I was crushed.
Do you notice since the announcement of the first iPhone, he's done that about four times? Before that, it was always, and they're available today. And since then, think about Apple TV. Think about a couple of the Macs. Think about both iPhone announcements. Suddenly he's gotten in this, he's found the value of announcing it, getting people excited, and then having another rollout later when it actually comes out. And I'm with you. It just makes me like, for God's sakes, why are you doing this?
Well, I think you know, who knows how many different factors go into it.
I know why he does it. I'm just saying I would rather, I like the idea of doing that and going out and buying the thing.
I think it depends on each thing. I think for the iPhone, it could easily be, you know, if it was to be released that day, there could have been any number of leaks.
Yep.
You know, people opening boxes early, you know, sort of stealing his thunder. I hear that this actually is now going to the FCC, even though it's a much smaller window than the first phone.
Yep.
And, you know, I can understand you're trying to ramp up your supply chain so that you have enough to meet demand. And, you know, in different situations, maybe Apple TV, they didn't quite have a bug worked out yet, or if a Mac, you never know from each product, or maybe that's just the way they do it now. We'll have to see if he ever actually says, and they're available today, you know, how that ramps up. You're right, maybe this is his new thing. What surprised me the most about that was the fact that they had been out of stock for a couple of weeks. And then I was like, well, if they don't make it available that day, that's just lost revenue. You know, it's another month of them not selling any iPhones.
That is weird.
And I'm stunned that they're willing to take it on the chin and not sell any for a whole nother month.
Yeah.
They're
one of the few products, or it's one of the few products that you could do that and get away with it. Because there's a pent-up demand of somebody going, okay, but I want this. I don't want to get something like it by Samsung. So most other, in fact, every other business out there would be terrified at the thought of that. Yet Apple can risk that. They're like the only one I can imagine that can actually risk doing that, knowing that it may not hurt them as much.
Yeah, and, you know, they talk.
Pardon?
Yeah, listen, and then listening. I'm sorry, it's. God, you're cutting out, so I'm interrupting you unintentionally. But listening to the Leo Laporte and the Alex Lindsay podcasts, you know, they're starting to say, okay, the distortion field's worn off. You know, now what are some of the negatives we're starting to think about? Like it's the end. By the time you've gone through your 2 years, you've paid a little more because the data charge is a little more per month. I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care either. That seems dumb. I mean, you're paying 10% more for data charge, but it's four times faster. It's suddenly a usable product, so that seems dumb.
It definitely didn't trip my cheapo tripwire, which, as you know, trips easily.
And especially if you're contrasting it with the $600 charge that was a year ago.
Right. You know, other things they're pointing out, it still doesn't have cut and paste, which is completely ridiculous. Although my friend Preston, who I talked about, he came up with a JavaScript solution that kind of does it.
Wait, what? What's ridiculous again?
It doesn't have copy and paste.
Oh yeah, I saw some guy who did a proof of concept to show how you could easily do this. That it just seems bizarre. They're not doing that, but I can't imagine that will. I can't imagine any reason it won't be put into place somehow soon.
You know, and now it's got the GPS, and the way they've done it is it kind of turns itself on and off so you don't suck the battery dry.
Yeah.
You know, it really, the only thing about it, which kind of gives me a little pause, is I was really wanting 32 gigabytes.
I agree.
Oh, so I was, and you know it's going to be out before Christmas. They'll have, you know, in the fall they'll rev it or something. Well, you don't know it. It would make sense if they did a 32 gigabyte version before Christmas, but I don't know if I want to wait that long.
Yeah, I am buying one in the net on July 11th or so. I'm going to get one, and I sent you an email. You probably didn't get it, but I'm definitely going to get one. But that whole 32 gig, it just seems. It's ridiculous. But I guess the one thing is what I'm realizing is I kind of put all of my entertainment on my iPod, and I just have a 30 gig iPod. So
you're talking about putting all you're putting all your media on your iPod.
Yeah, and I put all of my media on my iPod because I just can. So I kind of bounce around, and I you know, with a lot of my podcasts, I have to shuffle them around to delete ones to make sure I'm right at that angle. Well, basically so that means I can always take every song I ever liked with me and then a whole huge selection of podcasts. What this basically means is I have to manage this one differently. I have my iPod where I have all my music on and I can probably leave that in my car or something and or periodically do it. But this one here, I will use it to manage other stuff, you know, a selection of music and a bunch of stuff. I'll just have to figure it out differently because it's just not going to fit all of that stuff. So, and then the GPS, two of the reasons why I'm excited about getting this is supposedly TomTom has their software literally ready to roll to be used on the iPod so you can mount it in your car. And I love my TomTom and I love how the software works. And the GPS software that the Apple has on there, it's like this top down stuff I don't like, but the TomTom I love. So I'd love to be able to have that TomTom software on my iPod so when I go to other places I have a consistent look and feel. If it didn't work, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. And then also Sling Player. I love my Sling Box, watching TV from whatever, and apparently Sling Player has some software ready to go when they introduce it too, so you can watch your TiVo or whatever from anywhere. So those two things, and I definitely, there's no chance I'm not going to get at least the 16 gigabyte version, even though it's $300.
Well, the there was some drama. I mean, there's been drama back and forth about the TomTom thing for a while, and it's, you know, people went into the terms of service of being a developer for this and found that you're not supposed to do turn-by-turn directions. And people are saying, well, that means TomTom can't do it, and they're saying, well, no, if maybe TomTom's Apple's preferred solution for it, so it's anybody else but TomTom. So nobody really knows quite what's going on there.
Yeah,
everyone's just kind of hoping.
What I had read was that they said, well, first of all, a lot of that language is boilerplate, and like you're suggesting, they might have a deal with them, and a lot of it basically boils down to liability, to ensure that if you have something like this, that the liability issue is borne by TomTom, not Apple or something. So I'm sure they'll figure something out. I could hardly imagine them not doing it. The irony is, I just hardly imagine them not. But even if they didn't, it didn't matter. I still have a TomTom I guess I could take with me.
Yeah, I don't know. It's highly cool. I can't wait to get one. I don't know. I'm really looking forward to it.
So am I.
I quickly touch on some video game stuff. I'm maybe 45% through GTA. Thanks to parents last weekend and another visitor this weekend, I've had almost no gaming time. Just taking me forever to get through it.
Hmm.
Although it's, you know, I'm trying to streamline. I'm trying to streamline things now, so if I get a little bit, I'll look a mission up on the internet and see what's expected so I can be a little prepared for it so I don't have to redo it five times.
Yep.
Which is full-on cheating. I will admit that.
Wait, what are you doing that's cheating?
Well, if I start a mission and then I stop it and then I look it up on the internet and it'll say, oh, in this one you're going to be ambushed by the Albanians.
Yeah, but that's like, not okay. Cheating. That's like saving yourself one reset. Seriously, that's not cheating. You still have to get through the Albanians. You know, it's not like knowing that. I mean, all that means is, you know, oh, I saved myself 3 minutes to restart the thing. I wouldn't stress over that too much. That would, to me, that's not full-on cheating. That is little white lie cheating.
Ah, well, anyway, I need to... need to find some time this week and make some progress. Get over that 50% hump. And really, that's been about it. Trying to think if there was some... Yeah, it's really just been Grand Theft Auto in the machine. I've got a friend who has a Lego Indy. Said he would, lend me his copy when he was done with it. And it's like, oh, I'm really looking forward to that. But it's like, you know what? I've got this, and I still have Ghost Recon 2 that I need to get through. So it's not like I'm suffering from a lack of video games to play. I'm suffering from a lack of time to devote to them.
Yeah. I pulled out I have no money. Like, I get paid for the first time in 6 months on Tuesday. But I pulled out a Gears of War, just to play it again, tried to go through on the hardcore, because I didn't even go through looking for points the first time, or those cog things. So I went through it, and man, I don't know why, I must be the only guy in the world, I love first-person shooters, I don't like this game that much, and I know why everybody loved it, but for some reason, it just doesn't do it for me, and I played like halfway through the first mission, And right, and I just turned it off. I just not like, I'm liking it about as much as I liked it the first time. And I know I'm different than most. I know everybody loved this game. I, for some reason, I just don't like it that much. I don't know why. It's just,
Man, that's it. Now I feel like I, see, now I feel like I'm giving you Grand Theft Auto back so you can continue to wander around.
Oh, no. Well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't be playing Grand Theft Auto. If I had a choice, it would be, even though I didn't really like Rainbow Six Vegas, I would definitely be playing the second Rainbow Six game, Vegas game, because I like those kinds of games. Even though I'll bitch about them, that's the kind of game I like. And I don't know what it is about Gears of War, but it just, I don't know, it's something about it. Just, I don't really like it that much, but so I wouldn't be playing Grand Theft Auto at all. I probably would not pick it up again.
Gotcha. Well, I, before we sign off, I remembered something else I wanted to talk about.
Sure.
And that's, Ain't It Cool has had sort of a,
that's what?
A running, Ain't It Cool
yep.
has had a running, what's going on with Iron Man 2.
What is the
latest? You know, they say, oh.
Are they talking with Favreau?
Well, what I think the last thing I saw was about a week ago, but they were, you know, they said, okay, we're doing a sequel. And everyone's like, oh, of course we're doing a sequel. We're all interested. We've got these great ideas. And then Marvel announces the release date, which I can't remember when it is. And Favreau, like the next day, says, well, that seems, I don't actually agree with that release date. I don't think you can do a good enough job in the time allotted.
And by the way, you haven't talked to me about this.
Well, And that was the other thing, was that he said, you know, there'd been some preliminary talk, but nothing official. Yeah. And he says, you know, that's fine. They'll get to me when they, you know, everyone's busy. They'll get to me when they get to me. I'm not offended or anything. That's fine. And then they announce the release date, and he has the comment about it. And then it comes out that they did make him an offer, but they were lowballing him. And that was, I think, the last I heard. Like, he hadn't rejected it or accepted it, but that they had put out kind of a crummy offer. And I gotta be thinking, you know, we don't really know what's going. All we have to do is kind of go on what Ain't It Cool is reporting.
Yeah.
But from if that is what's going on, you have to wonder what Marvel's thinking. Are you insane? Why are you lowballing this guy? This was, you know, you gambled on this, and it's worked out phenomenally. It seems like, you know, you do a second one, you're printing money. Why wouldn't you do it right? Especially, you're trying to squeeze it into this release window. I mean, and that's kind of another discussion about release windows, and we can make all this money if we can release it then because no one else has claimed that weekend yet. You know, and we've got nothing for this fiscal year, but we've got too many things for that fiscal year. But it really seems like, why, you know, everyone agrees that this is a great film. Why wouldn't you take every opportunity to do it right on the second one? And it seems like they're trying to rush it, and they're trying to lowball the director, and that seems like, what are they doing? They were so smart the first time. What has happened that suddenly they want to shoot themselves in the foot?
Jesus. Yeah. You know, I wonder if Marvel, you know, took them so long to get around extricating themselves from those other deals that now they're trying to not have anybody else control their destiny, and they're trying not to have their destiny seem too tied to any star or any director or something. But, I mean, if that's the case, that's just stupidity, but I don't know.
My thinking, the only thing I can think of is from a business perspective, they know that the sequel is going to make a ton of money at least first weekend.
Yep.
And maybe they look at the numbers and they say, this is how much money sequels make. We don't have to invest. We don't have to go the extra mile to get Favreau back. We can put Brett Ratner or
Brett
McGee
Ratner.
Or, you know,
McGee.
Random director number three. We can plug that director in. They will service the script we have, and we will make all this money. We may make 10% less than if we had gone with the A-listers, but we'll still make enough, and we will have saved, you know, this, this, and this. And maybe that's what they're looking at it from, because they know how much money it's going to make, whether or not it's good, and they don't care that it's good or that it will make yeah. 10 million or 20 million more if it's good. To them, that math doesn't work.
Yeah, at a certain point,
maybe that's it. I don't know. But to me, it's they've engendered all this goodwill with the hardcore geeks, which, you know, look at Comic-Con coming up. The geeks are growing and growing and growing in number. Why would you then piss them off by, you know, to the, Jon Favreau is probably now a god and a hero to all these geeks.
Yeah.
You know, if he shows up at Comic-Con, he won't be able to move. He'll be so mobbed.
Yeah.
They've got all this goodwill that they've generated. You know, if they lowball Favreau and he decides to not take the high road and just say, even be honest and say, you know what, they're lowballing me. I'm not a greedy man, but what's fair is fair in this town, and what they're offering me is not fair. All these geeks are probably going to take Favreau's side and be like, oh, and then probably pay to see the movie anyway. So I don't know.
Well, speaking of money, so did you get my email about Indiana Jones where I kind of added it up? So I mean, my understanding was Ford, Lucas, Spielberg did not take dime one until the movie made $400 million internationally. Then after that, they equally split 80% of the gross money. Well, right now, as of the end of this weekend, when they finally add in the international money, it's made about $700 million internationally, which means that each one of them has made about $80 million from this movie. And it's possible that they're going to end up topping out at like probably $100 to $115 million each from this movie. You know, somebody was talking about Ford going, well, they're maybe wanting to do one more of these movies. I'm thinking, boy, if I was a 65-year-old guy and didn't really want to make the last one, and now I'm sitting on $115 million, it would be very hard to persuade me to make another one of these movies if I didn't want to make it. I mean, that's incredible, the amount of money that these guys are getting. And to their credit, they took a risk. They said this movie has to make, a third of $1 billion before we see dime one. So to their credit, you know, everybody's making money on this. And if it hadn't made money, they wouldn't have made any money. So I'm not faulting them for that, but it's an amazing amount of money they're getting from this movie. Amazing.
Yeah.
And it shows the power. It's one of the few movies out there that really is doing phenomenally better. It's done well in America, but phenomenally better internationally. So,
anyway. Right on.
By the way, I also watched Boogie Nights last night, the other night. I pulled that DVD out, listened to the commentary tracks. I was struck by how excited Paul Thomas Anderson was to do a commentary track, how he talked about getting John Sturgis and the Laserdisc track of Bad Day at Black Rock and how much he learned from that and how much he loves these commentary tracks and hopes he will listen to them. And then when you hear the cast commentary track, he literally sat through the movie five times. He went to Mark Wahlberg's house. He went to see Louis Guzman. He went to, you know, Julianne Moore, and recorded separate ones. They edited them together. So he was so committed to the commentary track that he basically recorded like seven commentary tracks that were edited into two. And ever since that movie, nothing. You know? It's just sad because he was so excited about them, and you could kind of see how excited he was. And all of a sudden now he's become this weird Kubrick kind of vapor that doesn't talk and just, you know, and I mean, he can do whatever he wants, but man, it was so exciting to see him talk about his movies and what it meant to him and stuff, and that's gone.
Yeah, well, I have nothing to add. I think we should wrap it up.
Okay.
And we will reconvene hopefully next week where we can discuss WALL-E, which hopefully we will have seen by then.
Yep, I'm definitely looking forward to that.
All right. You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. That's how you reach us. We have a website, mustardayonnaise.com, which it occurs to me we never plug.
We don't.
Whereupon we will post blogish entries as we think of them or are able to with our various jobs.
Yep. I put a couple on there. There's about three on there from the last week.
Yeah, I had a couple in the week before.
I just put one up today. It's the 50th anniversary of the murder of James Ellroy's mother, which is very sad.
Well, everyone.
Of course, it prompted him to become the greatest writer of the last 30 years. So,
well, everyone should go to the website and read that, no doubt, fascinating post.
Absolutely.
All right. So I am Matt.
And I am Richard.
And we both thank you for listening. See you.